Don't Give Up Radio Show with Jackie Wayans. Inspiration through word and song for you.
Though your world is torn apart and you're left with a broken heart and you feel that there's no real healing inside, oh no. But this I know, it's more than a feeling. Jesus said it in his word, you cannot feel it, just believe it. He'll make everything, he'll make it all right. He will make it all right. Oh.
Yes, he will. He will make it all right every single time. This is Jackie Wayans, your host of Don't Give Up Radio, and I'm thankful to be here with you another week, and I'm thankful that you are with me another week because, you know, we all experience midnight hours in our lives, but I'm here to tell you that it's not a time on the clock. It's a place that we all have to go through in our lives, and this show is designed to encourage you to make it that extra step, that extra mile, because we all need that along the way. Tonight, we're going to be listening to our guest, Jessica Janier, author of My Colorful World, and she is going to really share a fantastic history and wonderful account from her own life, going from the time she was a young girl all the way up to the present, born in Germany and moved from there to the bungalows of Far Rockaway, Queens. She really has gone through quite a transformation. Jessica, thank you for coming on and sharing with us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's an honor. I'm excited.
Okay, well, we're going to have a really good time tonight, and I know those who are listening will be able to relate. There's so much that's going on in our country right now surrounding the issue of color, and I just feel that this is timely in so many ways because it transcends just the issue at hand and goes beyond into only what God can do in a life. And so I want you to tell us, you know, set the picture for us. What was your life as far as you can remember when you were a little girl growing up in Germany? Can you share some of your earliest memories with us?
Sure. I was born in 1979 in a small town called Tiefenbach in Germany. And around that time, my mom was just going through a lot of her own issues and very stressed out. She was actually looking for an abortion, and after going through the town to different doctors and them rejecting her, they told her to go to Holland, and she couldn't afford to go, and so she ended up having to give birth to me. And she was a little overwhelmed by that, to the point where she actually asked her parents, my grandparents, to raise me. And I lived with them for the first 6 years of my life on a very small farm. And life was fun and innocent, and it was free. I mean, I was surrounded by farm animals and in the garden with my grandmother, and I just have memories of swinging on the swing in the back and taking sugar cubes to the ponies out in the pastures. So that was my life the first 6 years.
Wow, that sounds great, actually. It sounds also a lot warmer than I think of when I think of Germany. I don't think about those wonderful things that you just described. So that's really great to hear. But now, around the age of six, I understand that things shifted. They changed a bit for you. You came to the U.S. and you realized that there were family dynamics at play that you hadn't been aware of before. Can you share that with us?
Sure. My mom actually remarried while she was still in Germany to an African-American man, and they had two children while in Germany. So by the time we left Germany, I had two siblings, a half-sister and a half-brother, and the three of us, along with my stepfather and my mom, we came to Queens, New York, and that was now in the mid-'80s. And we ended up living with my stepfather's parents, who were, again, African-American from down south. And it was quite a culture shock for me, to say the least, coming from a small farm and a small town to this big city and moving into Queens in a pretty much all-black neighborhood and all-black home.
Right, and many people, you know, who are listening, they may have come in through Facebook where they've seen your picture. But just in case you're listening and you have not seen the picture, yes, Jessica is white, and she is lovely, like a beautiful, like strawberry red hair. And so I'm wondering about you and your sibling. Have you ever met them before this, or was this your first time with everyone coming together at this moment when you're transitioning to the U.S.?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we actually had met each other. They would come to my Oma's house, which is grandmother, and spend some time on and off through those years after they were born. So I was already familiar with them and knew that they were my siblings.
Okay.
By the time we moved to Queens.
All right. And did you think anything about the differences in how you looked at that time?
I don't think it really hit me until I got to New York. I knew that they were darker than me. My sister was very dark-skinned. You probably couldn't even tell that she was mixed. I mean, she was very dark-skinned, and her hair was very thick. But I don't think when I was in Germany that I really thought too much about that. It wasn't until I got to Queens and everyone, it seemed, looked like that, looked opposite of me, that reality started to hit me.
So now combined families in general are difficult, but your situation was made extra challenging, and combined families and biracial families, it can be stressful. And some would like to think not so much in 2014. But we're here in the mid-80s, and you've moved in with your grandparents here on your father, on your stepfather's side. And what was that like?
Oh, that was very crazy and very shocking. They were not very welcoming, to say the least. They were very upset that their son married outside of the race. And it was made known, you know, just by the way that they treated my mom and I. You have to remember when we came, I didn't know the language. My mom knew very limited English. So that was one barrier. We really couldn't communicate. But I knew that they had an issue with me because they became very abusive. I felt like they were always trying to hide me. I wasn't allowed to go outside, really didn't go anywhere. I had to stay in the room, couldn't jump on the furniture. It was all covered in plastic. And it was just a very rigid and strict home, you know.
Well, I can tell you about the plastic and the no jumping. That was just a rule across the board at that time.
I know. I saw that out afterwards.
But when you say abusive, what do you mean? Can you tease that out a little bit for us?
Sure. Well, I knew it was abusive when I started to get physically hit. And not just physically hit, but to the point where I was bleeding. Like one example would be my step-grandmother. If I so-called got in trouble, I did something wrong, I would have to go downstairs and get a switch and bring it back up to her. And I would get beat with the switch until the point where I actually bled and I felt sore for days.
And, you know, it's interesting because I come from an island background. I was born and raised here in New York. But my mom definitely is a traditional island woman, so I have been beaten with a switch myself, so I do know what that feels like.
You know.
But there's one thing to get whelped. There's a whole nother to draw blood, right? And on top of that, you also experience verbal bashing. What were the type of things that they would say to you?
Oh, man, they were calling me all types of names. Some of them I can't repeat on the radio.
Right.
But it was racist remarks, you know. It definitely was racist remarks. You knew that they had an issue. They were very disrespectful towards my mom, and they were just not welcoming. It was clear that they had an issue and that there was some resentment there and some hatred there, and I felt that it was really projected towards my mom and I a lot.
And so you're saying your mom and you, so your brother and your sister, your half-brother and sister, were the grandparents different towards them?
Yeah, they really accepted them over a period of time, and you could see the favoritism, the buying them things, the taking them to places, and you kind of got the sense that, okay, they're really treating them like their grandchildren.
Mm.
And so that caused a real internal conflict with me because I'm like, okay, wow, something's really wrong with me because they getting treated good and I'm here stuck in the room. I can't go where they're going. I can't have what they have. And it was very hurtful for a really long time.
So now your mom, she's there. Is she aware of the situation and what you're going through?
Yeah, my mom was definitely aware. My mom was going through her own challenge, and a lot of it I didn't understand until years later. Number one, my stepfather was very abusive to her. You know, here she is in a new country, trying to learn the language, no family. We had no family. We didn't know anyone when we got over here. And I just kind of felt like, at first I felt like, well, what's wrong with her? You know, why isn't she standing up for me? Why isn't she helping me? And I felt the few times that she did speak up, she got shot down really quickly. And I felt like her hands were really tied because she was stuck between a rock and a hard place.
Mm. Very, very difficult situation to be in. And I know from just speaking with you that one of the things that made this situation difficult, and we'll hear more about that when we come back from break, but your grandparents on your stepfather's side were actually practicing believers. They were, you know, churchgoers. He was, you know, the grandfather was a deacon, and, you know, she was the church hat lady. And you would hear certain, because in Germany you weren't exposed to God when you were living with your grandparents, correct?
That's correct. Yeah, there was no talk of God. I don't remember visiting a church or any talk about spiritual things in Germany.
So here you are, you come to the U.S., and the first example you get to see of that, unfortunately, is by people who are showing you a great deal of bias. And a great deal of abusive behavior. So needless to say, you cried many tears. We can be thankful because we know that our God cares for every tear that we cry, doesn't allow any of them to be wasted. When we return, we'll talk more with Jessica about where her life went from those moments in time.
No. so much stronger. It makes you so much wiser. Yeah. And you're so close to your dreams. And no mistakes, no heartbreak can take away what you're meant to be.
Don't Give Up Radio Show with Jackie Wayans. Inspiration through word and song for you.
Yes, that was Mary J. Blige and Each Tear. Wonderful song. No heartbreak, no heartache can take away what you're meant to be. God has a purpose and a plan for each and every one of our lives. And sometimes we don't believe that ourselves because of what we're going through, because of how dark our days are and all the things that we're facing. And sometimes we're just children. Sometimes we're just teenagers. And sometimes we just don't know the right way to go. And so this show is here to design to encourage you, to let you know that even in those moments, God is faithful. We're here with Jessica Janier, author of My Colored World, and she is sharing with us just the beginnings of her childhood, just growing up on a happy farm in Germany with her grandparents and all of a sudden being whisked away to Queens, New York in the bungalows in Bar Rockaway during the 80s when things were still quite rough and the world around her became colored, so to speak, and not just colored in terms of black and white, but colored in terms of moving away from just a positive, cheery childhood to now more complications and more difficulties. Now, Jessica, as time progressed and moved along, you and your mom and your stepfather were able to move out of the grandparents' home, but at the same time, you found that the abuse still continued. What kind of ridicule did you begin to face, not only in the home, but outside of the home?
Well, when I went to school, you know, I noticed that I always stood out wherever I went. And in the community where we lived, just predominantly all black neighborhoods, and so I became a target for being bullied and being jumped and just constantly having kids around me wanting to fight me and just attacking me verbally. And it was just this constant battle of trying to get home or trying to figure out ways to get home without getting beat up. And it was just like not happening. And I learned that I had to hit back and, you know, had to defend myself and just did not enjoy school because of that. Mm-hmm. And it created a conflict in me because I love learning. I was always a reader as a kid, and I love being taught new things, but I was afraid to be in school, and I felt that the teachers didn't understand me. Most of my teachers were white teachers, but by the time I had been in the States for a few years, I felt very disconnected from them. Mm. I felt that they really couldn't relate to me or they didn't understand me, and I didn't like them for that, and I didn't like myself after a while because of all of these different things that were happening.
So that's very interesting. So even though from the outside people are looking at you and they're saying, oh, you know, that white girl over there, but you actually didn't connect to that experience, and you didn't fully connect to the black experience either. You're just kind of in this, you know, trying to find your identity, trying to find your way, and you were already being told through your experience with your grandparents that you weren't enough, you were something to be embarrassed about. What about the abuse that was happening at home with your mother? Did that subside? What happened once you got your own place?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that abuse really started to escalate and become more prevalent. My stepfather was definitely a functional alcoholic. He always kept a job. But as soon as he got home, you knew that this might be the day that something crazy was about to go down because you just never knew what to expect from him. But you knew that it was going to be troublesome. And so there was just these constant verbal arguments between them and these physical fights, and then they would trickle to me, and he would start to pick on me and find little things. There was just a lot of psychological abuse also, like mental games and just crazy things that he would do. And it just escalated over time. It became more violent, became more prevalent, and it was just a really big problem in our home, to the point where our precinct knew us and the police officers knew us after a few years. It was like, okay, we're here again. What now? It was almost a joke, because they would come and charges were not pressed, or if they were pressed, they would be dropped right away, because my mom was just terrified of having to try to raise the kids on her own. You know, by the time when 89, 90, my mom had five kids by then, by 1990.
Oh, wow. Okay.
There were five of us. And we had, again, we had no family in this country. We didn't have a phone in our home. We were not in contact with the family from Germany, because he really kept us isolated from them. And so looking back, I say, wow, she was in really a hard place, because she was so dependent on this man, even though she was on welfare and getting government help. It just wasn't enough, and she was really struggling. And we just felt that tension and that stress in the home.
Right. And I'm curious, because between teachers and when the precinct knows who you are, you know, when the call comes through, did you ever have ACS get involved with your family or anything like that?
Mm-hmm, definitely. There was one particular case where they came to the house to interview us. But they never spoke with me directly. My stepfather threatened me. He said, you go in that room. If I see you come out, I'll break your neck. And I'll never forget it, because he was very serious. And he just sat in that living room with them and talked with them and had them laughing. And, I mean, he was just a very, very low-key guy, like very unassuming, you know, outside of the home and to other people. And he was really laid back and cool. And then it just seemed he was very believable. I mean, he would just say, you know what, my stepdaughter, she's very rebellious, and she's just a very angry kid, and he would say these things about me, and they believed him. And so even though ACS had come into the home a few times through the years, nothing ever changed. Nothing ever changed.
So, but the one thing that is remaining the same, and one thing that is consistent, is this concept that you are the problem, that really it's Jessica's issue. Jessica's the one who doesn't know how to behave. Jessica's the one who can't stop fighting in school. Jessica's the one who, you know, what happened or happened to you as you started to grow and develop into your tweens and teens, with this constant message that's being sent to you that you were the problem?
Mm-hmm. I think when you hear a lie long enough, you begin to believe it and you begin to accept it as truth. And there came a point, by the time I probably was 13, 14, that I was very resentful towards my mom, number one, and I said I would never, ever depend on a man. I actually started to hate men around that time, and I was really hating myself. I did not like myself at all. I was very self-conscious. I did not like people. I didn't trust anyone, and I was just very rebellious. I started getting into drinking and getting into drugs, started hanging with the wrong crowd, just started not even respecting authority, and really didn't care too much about whether or not I was going to live or die. And so by the time I was, you know, 15, I was suicidal and just really wanted to end my life, because I was like, what is the point? I'm just really tired. And I was really emotionally drained and mentally drained from all that had been happening in those years.
You know, and I have to say, in our society, it's very common for those of us who are older, in our 40s, 50s, above, to see young people acting out and listen to them, and we think, what is wrong with them? But usually it's because something is wrong with them. There is, meaning there are things that they have gone through in their lives that have caused this hardness, that has caused bitterness, that has caused what you're seeing to be displayed. And so the real issue is to get down into the heart of the matter and try to reach that young person. And the best way my Bible says to do it is through love. And I'm just wondering, because you are here today, because you are whole today, I'm wondering what gave you hope during those times when you were suicidal, when you, you know, were going through all of this. Why are you still here?
Well, I'll definitely say it's nothing but the grace of God, first and foremost, because statistically speaking, I should not be here after 3 suicide attempts and just some of the different situations that I've been in. But what I can say is in my battle between being hopeless and still believing that there was some hope, that God really sent different people into my life in different seasons, and he used those people to speak into me. People that would say things like, you know, I know you're going through something, I know it's hard, but hold on now. And there were certain seasons, there were specific people that God used to really keep me holding on. And I share a lot about those people in my book and just the impact that they've had in my life. And a lot of them showed me what love looked like, because I think that was the key. When you said love, I was not getting love from my home. I didn't feel loved. I didn't know how to love, and I surely didn't love myself. And you can't give what you don't have yourself. And so getting it from those places was a tremendous blessing to me.
Well, you indeed were walking around with a very fragile heart. And I'm here to encourage those who are listening to know that if your heart is fragile right now, the best thing you can do is put it in the hands of God, because he sees, he knows, he cares. And I don't want to sound cliche, because I've been certain places in my life he's brought me through. You're listening to Jessica. She's here today after she told you 5 suicide attempts, and she's here. 3.
Mm-hmm.
Suicide attempts, and she is here, along with other tragedies and things we will hear from. And I will share on this show Romans 10:9-10, that if you confess with your mouth and believe in your heart that Jesus Christ is Lord, you shall be saved. That's where the relationship begins. And if there's anyone to give your fragile heart to, it is the Lord.
Don't Give Up Radio Show with Jackie Wayans. Inspiration through word and song for you.
We are back with Jessica Janier, author of My Colored World, and she's sharing with us some very interesting and wonderful details of her life and her history. And we're really getting into the shift, the transition point of the story. And we shared a little early on that growing up in Germany, Jessica really hadn't even heard of God or the concept of God. And then coming here to the U.S., being introduced to a family that professed God and went to church, but having such a negative experience, Jessica, you actually didn't want to have anything to do with it, did you?
Absolutely. I was like, oh, no, I don't want nothing to do with your Jesus.
Yeah, yeah, I could imagine how that could happen. So here you are now. You're in the family. You now have five siblings. And you experienced a tragedy that really pushed you to make a move on your own. Tell us what happened.
Sure. Well, my stepfather and my mom were going through a custody battle, and this was after about 14, 15 years of living with just constant abuse. I think she came to the point where she realized that he might just kill either her or both of us or one of us. And there was an incident, which we don't have time to get into here on the show. However, it led to this custody battle, which led to him gaining custody of my siblings. And he was able to do that because, again, he was a very charming, very well-spoken man, had a good job, and really made himself look very good in court. However, when he received the win in court, my sister, Vicky, who was his oldest child, did not want to live with him. She wanted to stay with my mom and I, particularly with me. She told him, I want to stay with Jessica. And he got so upset that he told her, well, you're not my daughter anymore. And he pretty much disowned her. And fast forward that, it really led to a complete change in her where she became rebellious, started running away, getting involved in gangs, and she didn't even last on the streets for but a few weeks, and she was murdered. And after mm-hmm. that happened and that hit our family, it really gave me the drive. I mean, I was always very driven, but that really did something on the inside of me that made me say, I am not going to live a life where I'm going to settle for this type of environment any longer. Mm-hmm. And that was my drive to get on my own. I had gotten a good job. By then, about a year later, a year and a half later, I was a single mom and decided to go to college.
Well, actually, I wanted to ask you something because, you know, I just wanted to go back and sit on that just a little bit because that's a very touching moment on many levels. And so, you know, you lose your sister to the streets, and I'm wondering so many things. I'm wondering, do you think that your stepfather realized that his words that day had such a powerful impact?
I don't think so. I don't think he realized it. I don't think it was intentional. I think he had his own personal issues with my mom and I, and I think that he just felt rejected. And in his mind, he was thinking, wow, my own daughter is going to choose them or her over me, and I'm her father. And not being a mature adult and being an adult with issues, he spoke what he felt, not really thinking about how that would translate and how that would impact his daughter.
Right. And, you know, I was right before we went to break, I shared how sometimes we look on young people and we think, how can they act like that or do those things, but we don't understand the words that have been spoken into their lives and the things that they've gone through. And you made a very powerful point when we were speaking earlier about the power that men have in general to speak into the lives of young women and young men. Do you want to share on that a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. I didn't really have this revelation until probably in recent years, just how powerful men are. And when I started writing this book and I reflected back to the time when, you know, my sister was murdered and the events leading up to it, I really began to understand that young women and girls, we thrive on being validated by a man, by a father. And when we don't get that, there is a very deep void in us. And I also learned that my struggle with coming to Christ and even having this relationship with God was so difficult because I myself did not know my dad, and I still don't. And having that void of not having a father, and then having somebody who was supposed to be my father, who was abusive to me and rejected me, and, you know, just this pattern of seeing men as a negative versus really understanding that, you know, there are some good men out there, and thank God the Lord sent some into my life to show me that.
Yeah.
I had two men in particular that I write about in my book who God had sent into my life in two different seasons of my life, who spoke over me, who served as a protector or someone who encouraged me and just genuinely loved me for
mm-hmm.
who I am, and just shared things and just really allowed God to use them. And they didn't know. They didn't realize it at the time, and neither did I. But it really showed me how men are so powerful and have so much influence and are so needed. Now, it doesn't mean we can't operate without a man, and it doesn't diminish the value that we as women bring to the table. Definitely not. But there is a very special position that men were given where they are the protectors, the providers, and where they have this influence, especially when it relates to young people and young women, where they're
mm-hmm.
able to really pull out the best in us and to help shape the best that we can be. I'm totally convinced of that. The more that I read on it, the more that I look at my own experiences, and the more that I look at just relationships and people around me.
So, men, you may think that you don't matter, but you do matter, and your words and your actions are very powerful. So we need you and encourage you to be your very best, because there's a whole world hinging on the leadership of men in this country in particular. So I was hearing you. You said that, you know, here you are. You're taking this step out to move out on your own. You're a single mother. But do you get yourself on track? Do you find your course where you need to go in life?
I think it was the start. I was still very much in search of something. I didn't know what that something was. I knew that I wanted better and I wanted more out of life. I just didn't know what that was. I know what I didn't want, but I didn't know what I wanted, you know, if that makes sense. And it was like, you know, I had a good job. Yes, I went back to school, and I'm thinking, you know, at 22, 23 years old, I'm going to be okay with my Kayla. We're going to go live in Manhattan, and we're going to do this. And God had other plans, because my life really shifted a few months after she was born. I actually got a job in Brooklyn, met my husband, and totally unexpected. I was not looking for a relationship, and I always say, He is my angel, because God used him to shift the direction of my life in a way that I did not see coming, in the way that I had not planned. And I'm very grateful that God saw fit for us to meet. And, you know, we got married a year later, and by 2005 we had three kids. And that
Wow.
was a transition for itself, because I never knew how to raise a family. I didn't know how to be a wife or a mother. I mean, of course, I love my kids and I want the best for them, but sometimes translating these goals that you have in your mind is not that easy when you don't know how to do it, when you've never had an example, a living example. And so I kept hitting a lot of walls, and I found myself still feeling very empty and frustrated and kind of lost in my responsibilities as a wife and a mother. And I started a business because I figured, okay, there's got to be more to life. Like, I want to feel successful. I want to feel like I'm doing something with my life. And I started a business that I could work from home, and I ended up meeting a mentor, a business coach, and found out he was a pastor. And I was like, oh, no, please don't tell me this is happening, because I did not want to be bothered with anybody who had anything to do with the church. So I was very, very leery of him. Very leery, and didn't trust him, but I needed the money, and so I knew that the business was working, and we were starting to have some success in that, and it's just interesting how God used him to minister to my husband and I, began to counsel us and take us under his wing as if we were his own children, and would sit with us and speak on the phone with us. And when we had business meetings, he would begin with prayer. And, of course, I had a little attitude. I'm not going to sit here and say that I didn't. You know, I even pulled him to the side and said, can you, like, separate your spiritual religion from business? And it's like, I just felt like it was unnecessary, but I didn't realize that God was working in my life at that time and using him to really expose me to what I needed to be exposed to. And over time, it began to unfold and I began to understand it more. But it was a process, and it was a long process, and it wasn't easy.
Well, even as we were sharing just a little while ago about the power of a man being able to speak into someone's life. So here you are, you're in a business relationship with someone, but because they're a believer who has really committed their life to living for Jesus Christ, he's bringing prayer into your business meetings, he's bringing scriptures into your business meetings, because that's just an outflow of who he is. And it's my understanding that he also stretched himself outside of that to kind of, as you said, be a mentor to your husband and yourself as well, because both of you, and you, this is definitely God's blessing, because a lot of times I hear people who get married out of situations like the one you had, and it's a complete disaster. But your husband and you really wanted to make this work, and this business mentor actually mentored you in many different ways, to the point that your husband was actually the first one to accept the gospel of Jesus Christ, correct?
Yep, very true. My husband received the Lord first, and I was so mad at him because I was like, oh, no, now you're going to go and become a pastor too, and I had an attitude with him, and I was really very frustrated about the whole thing. And I remember we visited the church one time, our mentor, his name is Pastor Alan Plummer, and he had been inviting us to his church, and I was like, I am not going to no church. But, of course, over time, we really just loved him. We started calling him Papa Plummer, okay? That's how close he became to our family. And one day we just said, okay, we'll go to church just to kind of keep him quiet, you know? And we went, and my husband went up to the altar, and I was like, oh, no, you're not going without me. I had no idea what was happening or what was going on. And I realized it because my heart was so cold and I was so distant from God at that moment. But yet God was still working in my life. God was still loving me. God was still working out the plan and the purpose that he had for me. And that's what blows my mind and brings me to tears every time I think about it, because while I was rejecting him, God was still welcoming me and working on me and not leaving me. And it just amazes me that God he's just God.
Amen. So you followed suit shortly after?
About a year later, actually on my birthday, Pastor Plummer was actually preaching, and by that time I really felt the pull of God, and I was just tired emotionally, and I kind of felt like, why am I running? You know, where am I running to? You know, after a point, and what am I doing with my life? I started failing in business, and I started having these just different things were happening that was showing me that I needed God I needed something greater than myself. I needed something greater than my husband. I needed something greater, and that greater was Christ.
Yeah, because you've mentioned all through this about searching for something more and trying to fill a hole, and this moment comes and you realize it's the Lord. And so I'm curious to know, how has your life been? How has your family dynamics been, especially with your mom and your siblings, since you have given your life and just laid everything out into the Lord's hand?
Sure. Well, our process began before I really began to walk with God. When my daughter was born, I really saw that as a turning point where healing started happening in my family. My mom, who had been very depressed after my sister was killed, really became a different person. I started to see life in her again and joy and purpose when she just spent time with her granddaughter. And there was this sense of just joy that came into our family when my daughter was born. And I decided even back then, you know, that I was going to just forgive her and my stepfather and the different people that had hurt me, because I was very driven and I knew that I wanted to do something more with my life, and I didn't want to have that weight on me. I felt very heavy when I was angry with them, when I was bitter towards them. But when I made the decision, and it wasn't something that happened overnight, it was something that I had to work through, and I think for me, writing helped me, because I kept journals all through my teen years, and so I would write things down and I would evaluate things, and that helped me to really have some peace and to begin forgiving and to just let go of so much of that stuff. And fast forward today, my husband and I, we celebrated our 12th wedding anniversary this year. We have three beautiful children. I have a 14-year-old, a 12, and a 9.5-year-old. And if I told you that I saw this coming, it would be a total lie. I did not know that I would be a wife, a mother. I had no idea that I would have a book coming out in 2 weeks, that I would be speaking. And I mean, it's just unbelievable, honestly. It's nothing but the grace of God.
And your relationship with mom?
My mom and I are so close. We talk every day. I love her. I love her to life. She's amazing. And God is working on that relationship. I'm close with my siblings. And it's still a process, things that we are still working through. And every family has its challenges. Every family has its wounds that need to be healed, and some take longer than others. And we are in that process. But what I can say is that my mom is saved now. My siblings, they know who God is, whether they're walking with them or not. And that doesn't matter, because everyone has to go through their own journey and through their own process. But we have become a beautiful family, and I give God all of the glory for that.
Amen. That is completely, completely different from where you started out. And so we give God so much thanks for that. I want you to do two things before our time is gone. I want you to say a quick word to any mother who's listening who has lost a child like you have lost your sister to the street, and what words of comfort and wisdom would you share?
Sure. As a parent now, you know, I have not experienced the loss of a child, but I can say from being the oldest sibling, as an older sibling who's always been expected to look out for the siblings. My sister and I were 3 years apart. We were extremely, extremely close. And when she passed, I felt that a part of me, and I still feel that hole. It doesn't hurt as much because I know where she is, and my faith tells me that she is with the Lord. But when I look at my mom and I see the transition of how she dealt with the loss at a time where she did not have faith in God, where she was confused about it, where she felt so depressed, having to go to counseling and you know, get on medication and do all of these things to try to deal with this ache in her heart, in her soul. When you look at her today, she is praising God, and even though sometimes we don't understand why things happen, when we have faith in God, I really believe that there is a peace that comes, that overtakes us, that we know that all good things work together for good, number one, and that also that he's sovereign. He will help us to deal with these aches and these pains. And it's just it's a topic that is very difficult to touch on because it has so many different facets, but I believe that grief, especially for a mother, is one of the hardest types of things to overcome. And you don't really overcome it, but I think when you have the Lord by your side and you really believe that his word is true and you allow him to saturate your life with his presence, that there is a peace and that there is a joy that can come. And I've seen that in my own family. I've experienced it, and I've seen it in my mom in the recent years that she's begun to really walk with the Lord and get into his word. There's a transformation that happens.
Amen. Amen to that. And your book covers so much. I mean, we're not just talking about 12 chapters here or 15 chapters here. You really go through it, and they're, you know, short stories chronicling the mega moments of your life, and you deal with, you know, everything from the guy on the corner who watches over you to make sure nothing happens to you to, you know, death and all experiences. And so I want you to share with our listeners, where can they get their hands on My Colored World, any upcoming events you might have. Just tell us how we can connect with you.
Sure. I'm having my book launch event for those that live in the New York area at the Radisson Hotel in JFK on Saturday, October 4th. I will be doing a book signing, and there's a networking party and live performances. If you visit the website, lookupandbeyond.com, that's lookupandbeyond.com, you'll be able to see a video interview, and all of the details are there. And you can also connect with me on Facebook. I do a lot of Facebook networking, and I love to do that.
Wonderful. And indeed, your link is right here on the Blog Talk Radio page to your website, and people can get to you there. We've got to go. Next week, we've got a wonderful guest for you again, and I want you to stay tuned, but most importantly, I want you to hold on and don't give up. I want you to continue to be your own best hero, because the greatest hero of all gave his life for you. He said that you were worth it. So trust in that and know that he has already provided for you.
Thank you for your presence. Thank you for your presence. Thank you for your prayer. Thank you for your prayer. About
you need. Everything you need. Whatever you have need of, stands the Lord. I've already provided it for you. I've already provided it for you. I've already provided it for you. Yes, freedom and victory and liberty, it all belongs to me. He's already paid the price. He took the stripes upon his back. He already paid the price for you. He's made a provision. He's made a provision for you to be free, for you to be free, for you to be free, for you to be well, for you to be home. Every promise you can claim, every promise you can claim. I'm going to say that again. Every promise. He's put all things under my feet. He's made me the head and not the tail, above only and not beneath. Every promise. I've never seen the righteous forsaken or his seed begging for bread.